Great, so I'll start a session that's mainly devoted to empirical views of feedback this afternoon. And I really want to talk about three different things. So one is kind of using local laboratories, unusual nearby galaxies, okay, as examples where we can zoom in on what's going on with feedback. And then I'm going to talk about very normal galaxies at redshift 1 and the feedback in them. And then I'll finish talking a little bit about different ways to get at the quantity of the mass loss rate in these outflows, which of course is greatly compromised by the effect of the hot phase of an outflow, you know, can really only be seen for very nearby galaxies. So we're going to reduce this to even talking about just the warm entrained gas and whether we can come close to getting that number right, okay, from observations. So in terms of extreme environments in the nearby universe, major mergers of gas-rich galaxies, which can be identified as one type of them as EULAGs, are really, I think, in some ways analogs of high redshift galaxies in the sense that they are environments where large amounts of gas are being funneled into the center of a galaxy, okay, on a short time scale. And we know that in many ways EULAGs are quite different from, say, submillimeter galaxy population at high redshift. But they are an analogy to high redshift galaxies in a general sense of a lot of material is being funneled down into the central few kiloparsecs of the galaxy. Okay, so here's one of Phil's simulations. And notice the scale here of 100 kiloparsecs. If we were to zoom in on the very central region of this, where this is hot gas halo out here and in magenta is gas at 10,000 degrees, that would be kind of like this R-band picture of a EULAG here, where you see shells of stars, okay, coming off from the interaction. And along a slit here that's, oh, about 30 kiloparsecs across, okay, so roughly a third of the bar here, you can map out what the gas kinematics are doing. And that's what I'm showing you here on the right. Along this slit, this is the H-alpha emission line, and then two lines of forbidden nitrogen 2. And we can use these to trace out the gas kinematics, okay, across this EULAG. You can see out here where these shells are, there's still faint H-alpha, okay, detected. So I'm going to show you in the next picture spectra taken all along the slit here. Okay, so this is along the slit, and these are different diagnostic emission lines. And what I want you to notice first is in the nuclear region and kind of off one aperture either direction, there's a very broad component of emission in the wings here, okay, on the blue, particularly in this oxygen 1 spectral line, which is a great diagnostic, okay, of shocked gas as opposed to gas that's been photoionized by stars. So that shocked gas is in a broad component here. The other feature I want to draw attention to, okay, is this is the H-beta line, and besides the H-beta emission here, you can see broad absorption troughs. Okay, these are broad, these are widths that are what you see from stellar photospheres. Okay, so these are A-star features. You can see these broad absorption troughs are there well away from the nucleus, okay, in these apertures that are 10 kiloparsecs or so away from the nucleus. So that's interesting, okay, if we were to look at stellar population models, okay, as a function of times, okay, you can see for a delta function of star formation, the solid line here, you'd start out, okay, with an equivalent width in the stellar absorption of just a couple angstroms. And as a stellar population aged, and the O stars and the B stars died off, okay, you'd get very high Balmer equivalent widths of 8 to 10 angstroms when your galaxy spectrum was essentially an A-star spectrum. All right. And these are other slightly different models. So the point across this EULAG is if we measure the Balmer equivalent width in the center, okay, we get a few angstroms, like a continuously star-forming population. But if you go away from the center, out in either direction, these equivalent widths get very high. The spectrum looks like a pure A-star spectrum. So in the outer part of this EULAG, you're seeing a region where star formation has been truncated a few hundred million years ago, but it's ongoing in the center. Okay, this is consistent with this picture of a merger-driven gas inflow that's, and then the outer parts of the galaxy of the disk are essentially running out of gas here, and the starburst is ongoing in the center. So it's backwards, right, to how we normally think of galaxy formation. This is outside-in formation. And additional evidence for these inflows, okay, in these EULERGs is seen in the metallicity gradients, work by Dave Repke, where he sees in the center of this galaxy, it has an unusually low metallicity, okay, for the mass of the galaxy. This is presumably due to the dilution in metallicity from this gas that's flowing in from the outer galaxy. So if gas is flowing in from large radii, we'd like to know what happens to it, okay, in the central few kiloparsecs here. And we're able to zoom in on this central 2.5 kiloparsec region with adaptive optics, so the green box here. So now, observing this in the Paschen alpha line with OSIRIS at Keck, you see a map of the Paschen alpha emission. This is a map of the K-band continuum, so the stars and the gas. If we look at the velocity field of the gas, if you stand back, at first you see something that looks like a rotation curve, okay, rotation gradient across the galaxy. But then if you look closely, you see a little zag, okay, in the isovelocity contour here, which means when you fit a simple disk model to this and subtract it, you get a significant residual here in the middle. So this may well be something like streaming motions along a bar, okay, and the subtraction of that disk leaves a structure that looks kind of like this. So perhaps that is a gas bar, perhaps it is something else, but there's clearly some non-axisymmetric structure here in the middle of this disk that's probably transferring angular momentum, right, and is involved with getting the gas down to sub-kiloparsec scales in this galaxy. So let's move from the inflow now back to that large line wing, okay, that we saw in the shocked gas. And it's interesting, you know, when you see the blue wing in an optical emission line, you don't necessarily know from an empirical point of view whether that's inflow or outflow, because you don't know whether the gas is on the near side or the far side of the galaxy. So I was very intrigued when I saw this CO map, okay, this map of the CO line in the same galaxy. And in Claudia's paper here, she draws attention, okay, to these wings on the CO line. They go out to about 1,000 kilometers per second, both to the red and to the blue. And this range in velocity is very similar to the range on the blue wing, okay, that we see in these optical lines. So presumably in the CO here, we're seeing all the way through the galaxy. And in fact, the neat thing about this map is this is a picture of where the blue wing is, okay, gas between 3 and 600 kilometers per second on this side, and this is the red wing. But in the optical lines, basically, if this is all outflow, the red wing is obscured because it's on the backside of the galaxy. Okay, so we're just not seeing through the galaxy. So in galaxies like EULERGs, whereas all this gas flows in, lots of dust flows in the middle of the galaxy, and they become very opaque at optical wavelengths, you wouldn't think you'd learn a whole lot by looking at them in the ultraviolet. And of course, to convince, right, a time allocation committee to let you look at a EULERG in the ultraviolet, you've got to remind them that submillimeter galaxies, half the redshifts we know for them, came from Lyman Alpha, from Scott Chapman's early work. So compared to the optical picture of this same EULERG that I'm using as a case study now, okay, this is the same galaxy in the near ultraviolet and in the far ultraviolet. So when we go look at these galaxies with fuse, and this red circle is the 2.5 arc second diameter of the the Coss spectroscopic aperture, we've almost got a point source, okay, in the middle from this EULERG. And then this shows the Lyman alpha spectrum. These are blue shifted velocities here, and this is red. This is a telluric line. Forget this feature over here. But there's a huge blue wing here, okay, going out to 2,000 kilometers per second in Lyman alpha. So for those of you who used to think about modeling Lyman alpha radiative transfer, right, the canonical picture in a galaxy is an expanding shell. And you see backscattering off the red side, and you see blue shifted absorption and red shifted emission. Okay, so a blue shifted emission wing here is not necessarily what you expect to see. And you think, well, it's Lyman alpha, okay, there's something complicated going on, there's lots of scattering going on, right? But look closely here, okay, at this range of velocities. Right, our fundamental question here is there outflowing gas at 2,000 kilometers per second? Or is there really gas going out at 200 kilometers per second and something scattering off it many, many times and getting boosted up to high velocities. Well, remember there were wings on the optical lines, and if we zoom in here, okay, on the base of the H-alpha line profile, see there's a wing going out here to 2,000 kilometers per second. Okay, this is a little confusing because the hydrogen alpha line here is blended with the nitrogen 2, so let's look at the oxygen 3. Look at the blue wing here. I mean, it's getting out there, maybe not quite all the way to 2,000 kilometers per second, but pretty close. So the bottom line here is that I think when we look very closely at nearby galaxies, galaxies where when we look at them in resonance absorption, we see a blue shifted line that's, you know, has a center to the Doppler shift of maybe 300 or 400 kilometers per second and a wing that goes out to 600 kilometers per second. In emission now, in CO, in Lyman alpha, in these optical lines, there are wings going out to close to 2,000 kilometers per second. In this particular ULIRG, one where there's no direct evidence for an AGN. Okay. Now, stepping back from a case study to a sample of ULIRGs to show a couple general trends, this is work from Kurt Soto's thesis that's published in these two papers, where he did this decomposition of the optical emission line profiles, okay, into a narrow component and a broad component, and then looked at the excitation mechanism, okay, in the narrow component and the broad one, using these diagnostic line ratio diagrams that were made popular by Sylvain and others. And in these diagrams, right, in this region, you're familiar with the idea that these are regions that are photoionized by stars. And as you get up in this region, you can either be photoionized by a power law spectrum, or you can be shocked. And this grid up here is a grid of shock models, okay? And what we find, okay, is that as you go into the broad component, okay, the components that have velocity dispersions of more than about 150 kilometers per second, the line ratios always look shock-like. And then the narrow components, they're a mixture, okay? Depending on where you are along the slit and which galaxy, sometimes they look like they're photoionized by stars, sometimes they look like there's shocks there. And the shock velocities that we fit, okay, are generally similar to the velocities we get from the Doppler shift of the resonance absorption lines, like sodium D, okay, in these galaxies. I should say that we think in general that these are not narrow line regions. The size of them, okay, tends to be several kiloparsecs across, and they don't fall on the empirical in scaling relations for O3 luminosities and the sizes of narrow-lined regions, okay, at least in the subset of the ULIRGs that we're looking at that have cool mid-infrared colors. So now looking at the Lyman alpha for 11 galaxies here, okay, just skip this, this is a grid of 12. There are two non-detections of the Lyman alpha, and we see pretty prominent Lyman alpha in 9 of the 11 ULIRGs. And there's a lot of variation, okay, in these line profiles, but there is a general trend, okay, for these blue wings to be fairly common. We're working now on doing some radiative transfer modeling of these with Mark Dykstra, and I'll just draw attention to two examples. Now, in the models here, I'm sorry, we've got this switched, okay, in the data, on the left is blue shifted. In the models, on the right is blue shifted. So you got to do a mental mirroring here. But for example, we'll look at this object which has been fit over here, because this is the galaxy in the set that's not truly a ULIRG. Okay, I said these were all major mergers, and this is one that's caught in an early stage where there's two separate galaxies there. And in fact, the galaxy that has the strong 60 micron emission and is truly an ultraluminous infrared galaxy has zero UV flux. So we took our cost spectrum of the other galaxy, okay, which is a star-forming galaxy, and it's the one in the whole sample that shows what you expect, okay, this blue-shifted P Cygni absorption trough and a red-shifted Lyman alpha emission. And this is Mark's fit to that, okay, he gets an outflow velocity of 80 kilometers per second and a column density in neutral hydrogen of 10 to the 20. Now the rest of these, to get these blue wings, he's able to fit them with a model for a spherically expanding wind, okay, And then fairly low columns, okay, of neutral hydrogen, 10 to the 18 to 10 to the 19.5. And we're trying to see if there's a sequence to this. When we get all the way to the one object that is clearly an AGN, that in these diagnostic line ratio diagrams, actually the nucleus falls in the part of the diagram where it looks like it's photoionized by a power law spectral energy distribution, okay, we see the object that has the strongest blue wing in the sample, okay, the largest fraction of the area out here to large velocities. So it probably goes well beyond 2,000 kilometers per second. And not too surprisingly, if this is an AGN, okay, when Mark fits this wing, he gets a H1 column of 10 to the 17 per square centimeter, right? Which is kind of like a magic number because it means your H1 column density is getting so small that you're optically thin to the Lyman continuum. So perhaps there is a progression here, okay, in these Ullrichs. This has been suspected for a long time, but never directly shown, that as these winds make bubbles and are clearing gas out, we're clearing out holes where not only UV radiation, but ionizing radiation is starting to escape. And it's exciting that maybe we will be able to show that as a sequence along with merger time here. Now, at this point, we can calculate or estimate an escape fraction of the Lyman alpha photons because we have a measurement of the H alpha luminosity. And then for just straight case B recombination, we can say how many Lyman alpha photons there would be and compare that to the number measured. And then we can look at how they compare to things like the gas kinematics. So this is just an example showing the width of the lines. I could talk more if you're interested in how that's measured, of the Lyman alpha line versus the optical lines, the O3 in this case. And basically, they're well correlated. Where the optical lines are broad, so is the Lyman alpha. And then the Lyman alpha escape fraction, okay, correlates well with this width of either an optical line or the Lyman alpha. That is, the lines get broader and there's a bigger blue wing, there's a higher escape fraction. The Lyman alpha escape fraction also correlates, okay, with the amount of reddening. This is the reddening measured from the Balmer decrement. The Ullrichs are the blue squares here, shown on a plot from Hakeem et al., okay, combining these samples. So in this diagram, they don't look so different from normal galaxies. So that's the picture, this first part of the talk on the local laboratories. And the new thing is this very high velocity gas in galaxies that seem to be starburst. So moving away from very extreme objects in the local universe to galaxies that are truly common, okay, at redshift 1. Where we go to a color magnitude diagram and at random just pick galaxies out of the blue cloud. And then we went and observed 200 of them with the LRES spectrograph at Keck, okay, which is very sensitive up to the atmospheric limit in the blue. So we can observe near UV spectral lines, okay, from galaxies from redshifts 0.4 to 1.4 in this sample. And these are just some composites made showing changes in stellar mass, with color and with luminosity to show some of the properties of the resonance absorption lines in these galaxies. And two of the things to take away are first that there's a sequence of iron II absorption lines, okay? Five different lines shown here, two more lines further to the blue that are weaker. So we can truly do a curve of growth analysis with iron II lines that have oscillator strengths that vary over a little more than an order of magnitude. Okay, and measure a good solid column density, at least in the iron II ion. In general, these resonance absorption lines tend to be saturated, and you can't get column densities out. And it's even worse than that, as this magnesium II doublet shows you. As we go to the lower mass objects, okay, from black to red to blue, you can see hints here of emission, of resonance emission in the magnesium II. And in fact, even in these troughs, there's got to be quite a bit of magnesium II emission filling the troughs in to get what are basically backwards line ratios compared to the ratios of the oscillator strengths. So this is some of the key properties here. If we take the column densities out of the iron II here, and do a lot of hand-waving, okay, about the ionization correction, and the depletion and the metallicity of the wind. You can argue that if these things are launched at a radius of about a kiloparsec, where this number alone is probably uncertain by an order of magnitude, that you can get mass loss rates up to about 23 solar masses per year in these objects, comparable to their star formation rates. But these numbers are quite uncertain, right? This is order of magnitude, at best, accuracy here. I think the most interesting thing to come out of this study is actually that not all of the star-forming galaxies at redshift 1 showed blue-shifted resonance absorption, okay, in their spectra. In contrast, right, when you look at Lyman-Brake galaxies at redshift 3, when you're able to look at lensed ones and look at them individually, every single spectrum shows one of these outflows. And in this case, whether we divide it up by redshift, okay, or by stellar mass, or by star formation rate, the things in blue here showed outflows, the things in red actually showed inflows, the symbols in black are consistent with being at the systemic velocity. So what's going on, right? If only half of them basically show a blue shift of 50 kilometers per second or more, what's going on with the other half? Well, you know, we thought this would correlate with star formation rate or mass or something, and it doesn't correlate with any of these quantities. So we're left with what's kind of obvious in hindsight, that it must be orientation. That probably all of these, the fact that we see it half the time, and at slightly higher velocity, see it in 1 out of 5, suggests that, as in local winds, the winds are highly collimated, okay, into bipolar or conical flows. And this is the fraction of the time, or the fraction of the of a solid angle, okay, that's subtended by the outflow. And this is a remarkable thing, because, like I'm saying, at redshift 3, the outflows are very much into 4 pi star radians, because you see it in every sight line. And even at redshift 2.5, okay, the outflows have pretty much a 4 pi star radian solid angle. So this is neat, because I think we're seeing the effect, right, of the emergence of gas disk in galaxies, and we're seeing their effect on collimating these outflows. And it's happening somewhere between redshift 2 and 1, okay, where these outflows are becoming collimated into bipolar flows, probably for the first time. Now, to test this hypothesis a little better, we were able to get archival HST imaging for about a quarter of the sample. And this just shows, as a function of disk inclination, okay, where these are the face-on disk and these are the system seen edge-on, what the measured Doppler shifts were in these resonance lines. There's a definite trend here for the face-on galaxies to be the ones where we see the blue shifts and the edge-ons to be the red shifts. Okay. So I think the fact that, in general, we're not correcting these measured Doppler shifts for disk inclination when we estimate outflow speeds is what causes a lot of the scatter when we try to make global scaling relations. Okay. So this is just the trends here of outflow velocity with galaxy luminosity. And you can see when you do this over orders of magnitude, there is a trend, but within any one sample, like our Z of 1 sample, you don't see a tight trend. And I think it's due to these sorts of errors. So I mentioned with the magnesium 2 that in individual spectra, you could see strong emission. It's much like Lyman alpha, it's a resonance line. Okay, so the photons are scattered around. And in this case, for a few galaxies, this emission is spatially resolved, okay, along the slit. So you can measure the size of the scattering halo. I don't have time to go into this in detail, but basically this the optical depth for scattering, okay, in the Sobolev approximation depends on the volume density of those scattering ions and is inversely proportional to the velocity gradient. Well, the velocity gradient we can measure directly from the spectrum because we've got a size and we've got a velocity, and the size the scattering halo is presumably where the optical depth is close to unity. So we can solve this and measure, okay, an actual volume density in the wind at a distance 10 kiloparsecs out. And if you do this, you get densities, okay, in magnesium, singly ionized magnesium, about 10 to the minus 9 per cubic centimeter. And you can just plow through the numbers here, you know, to get to a hydrogen density, right, you clearly need to know an abundance. That's probably within a factor of two of solar. You need an ionization correction, okay, that we could argue about for a long time. But we've done some photoionization modeling. We argue this is a large correction. And you get up to mass outflow rates in this particular galaxy that are about 500 solar masses per year, or up to that. The star formation rate in this galaxy is about 80 solar masses per year. Okay, and this gives you a mass loading factor of 4 to 6. This is another example from Kate Rubin's work. She gets close to 1. So that's a little better, okay, in terms of getting at mass outflow rates than these column densities were, where I said we were off by orders of magnitude. But clearly here there's still a big correction for ionization. We've only got 2 examples. But we've learned something important here, okay, from the collimation of these winds, that basically when you look through the halo of a galaxy, you may see different things depending on where in the halo you look, whether you're intersecting this wind or not. And there's been some very exciting empirical work, okay, in this area. One of Sujin Shen's simulations, okay, where you see outflow here and inflow coming in along a disk. This is work of Nicolas Boucher, who's chairing our session today, so I'm going to get an extra minute from showing his plot here. And he basically looked at background quasars, okay, where the light goes through the halo of a foreground galaxy, and paid attention to where the quasar was relative to the major axis of the galaxy. So these are sight lines that intersect the galaxy near the extended major axis, and these are the sight lines that intersect a foreground Sloan galaxy, okay, near the minor axis. And if we restrict our discussion of intervening absorption, okay, to strong absorbers, okay, things with equivalent widths more than 0.3, 0.5 angstroms, the distribution seems to be bimodal, okay, that you see these strong absorbers here, which may be related to gas accretion. You see them out here, which is presumably related, okay, to these galactic outflows. Did Rongman make it? I know he was, I haven't seen him today. Okay, he's on the schedule, he should be here. Rongman Bordoloi, okay, stacked a bunch of galaxies at higher redshift, basically found a similar trend, okay, that these minor axis sight lines depended a lot, okay, on that there was a big difference, okay, at a given impact parameter, whether you were along the minor axis or the major axis. And this excess along the major axis, okay, being attributed directly to galactic winds. And I think this all needs to be tested a little better, but if it's right, it's a big deal, because it says when we see an absorber along the minor axis, we can associate that gas with galactic wind instead of accretion or hydrostatic gas. If we can do that, we can get properties. Okay, so another example from the Boucher paper, where here's a quasar, here's a galaxy, and then you see the absorption in the quasar spectrum, the 2 magnesium 2 lines, you try to model that. Basically, the blue line's an inflow model, the red fit is a disk. Sorry, the red fit is a biconical outflow. You fit this, you get an outflow velocity. And in this case, for the ionization correction, an empirical correlation, okay, between magnesium 2 column and H1 column, based on Sloan sight lines, was used. And you get up to mass loading factors, okay, of about 0.3. And then this is our latest from this work in this area, just appeared on AstroPH, where I think this is the first time where we've got an outflow detected in a quasar sight line. Okay, that's this one right here. And we see the outflow, okay, in the galaxy spectrum, which is these 2 lines, where the red lines here are 0 velocity. And the galaxy itself, okay, has got a well-defined rotation curve. You see kind of a double-humped profile here to the H-alpha line. And we try to model this guy, and we do even better, because we were so lucky that there was actually a spectrum of this quasar in the HST archives. This is the cost spectrum. We've got multiple ionization states. You do the photoionization modeling, okay, and we end up, again, with mass loading factors 0.1 to 1. And I have 1 minute left, and I have 2 slides left. So Nicholas will be very happy. Fourth and final way to get at this mass loading parameter is through the mass metallicity relation. Okay, so there's a set of empiric equilibrium type models, okay, where I won't go into the details of those, but they make a prediction, okay, that when you're kind of below the characteristic mass for galaxies, that your metallicity should rise with the halo mass to the one-third power for momentum-driven winds. It's the solid line here. And for energy-driven winds, okay, you get a steeper relation. So right now, the trick to measuring the slope, right, is to measure the mass-metallicity relation down to lower stellar masses. And this is work from Elena Henry that used a set of emission line selected galaxies that go about a decade lower in stellar mass than where you've seen a mass-metallicity relation for intermediate redshift galaxies before. And the red, dark red points here are the medians of these other points. They're not really good enough right now, okay, to distinguish the scaling between the eta's for the momentum-driven and energy-driven winds. But using MOSFIRE on Keck, okay, to improve both the metallicity estimates and estimates of star formation rate and estimates of reddening, the error bars on these individual points, okay, are shrinking to about a third of what they are. And Juhan Yoon, who's here, has a poster, okay, on this work. And I think it's pretty exciting because the individual points here are getting good. We're going to be able to distinguish, okay, between these two models and also look at how the scatter in the mass-metallicity relation, okay, depends on things like specific star formation rate surface density, galaxy morphology, etc. So just to summarize, main results I want to leave you with here right now is that there is some very high velocity gas now being detected in extreme starburst in the local universe. Sylvain will talk more, I think, about high velocity gas and its relation to AGN. The objects I've shown you, it's not clear whether any AGN is required to get the gas up to those high velocities. It may be completely starburst driven. I think the evolution in this outflow solid angle that we find with cosmic time is exciting because it's another way of probing the emergence of gas disk in galaxies. And, you know, mass outflow rate measurements are something that's been laughed at for a long time. And what I want to leave you with today is the idea that from these column density measurements alone, things have gotten a lot better because we can do curve of growth now. We don't just have saturated lines. There are still big uncertainties in the ionization correction and the launch radius. We get over some of this, okay, by imaging the scattered magnesium-2 emission, because then we know what radius the gas is at, okay? And then finally, is we have specific examples that have multiple absorption lines from different ionization states of silicon and carbon in these cost spectra. I think we're getting numbers that are now pretty good, factors of 2 or 3 accuracy. Thanks.
Thank you, Crystal. We have time for some questions.
This is partly a question and partly just something I wanted to mention because I think it's interesting to discuss. So for the wind models, there's a fairly long-standing problem where if you just pick some power law wind mass loading and assume the simplest model where it's, you know, once it's gone forever, and that everything in the disk was uniformly mixed before it's ejected, the models that have done that, semi-analytically, in my impression, is also the first runs with the illustrious simulations. You underpredict the amount of metals in low-mass galaxies because you have to have such a big mass loading to get the baryons out that you blow out all the metals that they form. And, you know, it seems to be telling us something potentially really cool about, you know, this not being uniformly mixed or different recycling times for different components. And I'm really curious about your take on this, especially with that second to last slide. And, yeah, also just wanted to bring it up.
So I guess I wasn't quite sure from your comment whether you're saying the simulations would not lie on these relations that these equilibrium models analytically predict, or?
So, well, I know if you talk to Ramil, he'll tell you that if he assumes that it's uniformly mixed and that
he fits the mass loading he needs to fit the mass function with that sort of simplest model, he can't get the right mass metallicity relation.
Yeah. I mean, empirically, my one comment would be, in very nearby galaxies, there's always been a hint that the metals synthesized kind of in a starburst mode may go directly into a hot phase, you know, and never mix with the rest of the ISM. I mean, it comes from a couple things, right? Chip Kobylnicki's work back in his, you know, thesis 15 years ago, right, looked at individual H2 regions, looking for signs of enrichment from individual stars in the warm ionized gas. And they could basically never find it, right? The inference was these metals must be going directly into a hot phase. We did some work measuring metallicities from X-ray spectra in NGC 1569, a dwarf starburst, and saw that, you know, the hot 10 to the 7 degree gas was definitely enriched relative to the warm 10,000 degree gas in the H2 regions. And the inference was the numbers kind of worked out that literally you could take, you know, all the oxygen made in the last 10 million years in the starburst and put them in that hot phase, and it may never have directly mixed with the warm gas in the ISM.
I would like to make a comment on whether you have a momentum or energy-driven wind. So that's where you basically determine the momentum or energy, the base of the wind. Yeah. So if you have actually a cosmic ray-driven wind, that is actually not true. So you can actually constantly repower the wind in its ascent and in the halo, and that may have a different signature. Have you considered this type of wind?
No. Do you have a simple? I mean, not in the terms of the mass metallicity relation, but it would be great to know. I mean, we're going to make a measurement. It would be great to know if, for example, a cosmic ray-driven wind can be distinguished in this diagram. I mean, the one way I know to distinguish it, right, is just, as you said, from the difference in the acceleration at large distances, which is a measurement we seek but don't have right now. But I think, you know, one thing we need from the cosmic ray-driven winds is more ideas of how to distinguish them from other types of winds.
Other questions?
So just getting back to the Lyman alpha, I don't, from Mark's modeling, I don't quite understand how you get a blue wing with an outflowing shell. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
So
especially an optically thin one.
One thing you do is you have to start with a blue wing. So I didn't get to describe this in much detail. The model that goes in, right, the distribution of Lyman alpha photons you're starting with here, he starts with the idea of there's an H2 region, okay, in the middle of this ULERG, and there's an outflow. And the side of the outflow that we see coming this direction has this blue wing. So he takes the H-alpha line profile as a model of what the intrinsic Lyman-alpha profile looks like. And then he lets this scatter. And then it basically amplifies, you know, kind of the fraction of photons that are at high velocities relative to zero velocities that escapes. But he can't get it without starting with a blue wing.
Right. You also seem to get a lot of Lyman alpha at line center, which you don't see in a lot of Lyman alpha models.
Yeah, although typically there's a trough right at line center.
A couple did, but a couple didn't as well. A
couple don't, yeah. There we go. Quite a few of them do. And here, these guys, this one, all of these troughs, when they appear, when you line them up with the optical emission line profiles, the trough is right where the peak in the optical emission is.
Yeah, that's what you'd expect. But
yeah.
The other ones, any ideas?
No. I mean, it's a mystery to us.
Another short question, maybe? If I could keep it short.
I guess I just want to comment. In Marketing 231, we published this paper on cost data where the Lyman alpha, it's certainly the most amazing Lyman alpha we've ever seen, is completely blue shifted by 3,500 kilometers per second. Nothing at zero velocity, nothing in the positive velocities. Everything is highly blue shifted. So it would be interesting to see how it fits in that picture.
Yeah. Although you're clearly an AGN there, so maybe in a very different regime.
Yeah,
yeah. No more questions? Let's switch to next speaker. Now we're going to hear from Dushan on star formation-driven galactic winds from the fire simulations.